Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to the show. And guys, we're back. We're back in interview season. Got it? It's been a bit of a train wreck as far as coordinating the interviews, but we are back with our Viceroy of Value, as I call him. The Thunder from Down Under, Mr. Toby Carlisle himself. And just so you guys know, see, it's sort of like introducing a boxer. Remember Rocky III? Remember that?
I love it. Yeah, of course. What a great movie. That's Clubber Lang, Mr. T.
Yeah, he'll knock you into tomorrow, Rock. But remember how long it took Apollo Creed to get all of his superlatives and all of his nicknames? You know, it was like a 10-minute deal. That's kind of how I want to get eventually with you, where we spend half the interview me just wrapping it off, right, all the different names. We've got you on, obviously, to talk valuations. And the reason we've got you on is, A, I like you. And also, Toby has written four published books on value. Not a lot of guys have done that, especially not in the last 13 years.
It seems excessive, doesn't it? It's a little bit too much. I gotta get a hobby.
No, I love it, man. And I not only that, but I get to read them. But we got Quantitative Value, Deep Value, The Acquirer's Multiple, and Concentrated Investing.
Yeah.
I've read them all. I would strongly suggest you guys do it. But it takes a bit of gravitas to keep publishing these value books in the middle of the biggest value deluge market, right? It's been a train wreck. But if nothing else, it shows we got some serious conviction here, right?
I'm a believer. I mean, I think that the logic of it is pretty persuasive. And I think that, you know, everybody who's sort of newish to the market always says, well, value is sort of old hat, and Ben Graham wrote this stuff in 1937 and it doesn't work anymore. But then I say, you know, the objective of what we're trying to do is just to buy a series of cash flows starting from today and going out until kingdom come. And then we're going to discount them back to today. The more predictable the cash flows and a little bit of growth, and you've got a management team that's buying back stock, like, that's going to work. I don't know what's in the index. I don't know what's in some of these very growthy ETFs. When I look at them, they haven't really done anything. I just find the logic of it is pretty compelling. But, you know, in the short term, anything can happen. It can underperform. It can outperform. None of it's really meaningful. The real measure of it is a 3 to 5 to 10 year kind of track record.
100%. And the other thing is that if you make a practice out of buying a dollar for 50 cents, which you and I both know that there's still, as crazy as this market is, some of these names, some of the valuations, some of these companies that you're buying at the, and they have the growth. That's the irony. They just, it's not tech. It's not the sexy thing. So they're just not getting loved. If you make a career out of buying a dollar for 50 cents, you're going to be just fine.
Well, and in addition to that, the way that I think about it is I sort of require the things that I buy to show me. I want to see it in the financial statements. What are you doing? And I don't really like these ones where they promise you that they're going to do something, and then the market values them as if they've already achieved it. And then when they come out, you know, a quarter or so later, and they say, oops, we missed it, and then they get cut to pieces. I've just had that happen to me enough times that what I really want now is a management team that sort of under-promises, over-delivers, and then when they get cheap, they spend their time buying back stock because they believe in it too. And then what that creates is this, even if the top-line growth is not spectacular, even if the top-line growth is only inflation or a little bit better, the bottom-line growth, which is really what you care about as an investor because that's what flows through to you, the free cash flow.
Wait a second. Profitless revenue growth doesn't pay investors? No.
Shocking, I know. Shocking.
Sorry, when, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, when that flows, you know, the free cash flow is ultimately what you care about because that either flows through to you as dividends or buybacks, or it's reinvested in the business, which then grows, and that's how the growth occurs. That's what you want. And so even though the top line growth might be just inflation or a little bit better, the bottom line growth or the free cash flow growth can be quite spectacular on a per share basis. And I think that that's what people miss often. If you go to Morningstar and you type in ZIG, which is the ticker for the Acquirers Fund, you can have a look at my portfolio versus the index portfolio versus the average portfolio in the category. And you'll see that the top line growth is comparable to the index growth or to the average fund in the category, but the bottom line growth is considerably higher, and that's by virtue of the fact that they do these buybacks, because that juices your returns as a shareholder if you remain, and ultimately that's what you should care about.
Yeah. Now, while I was getting ready to talk to you, first of all, it's been too long. I was reminded of the first time you and I chatted. I remember sitting in a little deli in downtown Seattle. We're just getting to know each other, and we were talking. This is what was this? Probably 2017, maybe 2016,
right.
Somewhere in
yeah.
there. You were up here doing a CFA meeting in Seattle, and we were talking about how insane the markets were and how nuts valuations are. Little did we know. So, first of all, the thing that I wanted to talk to you, and you and I haven't spoken in some time, where are we at historically? Because I know the people listening to the show now are going to be like, Zach, you're always telling us how crazy. Yes, I am. But it's also historical, right? As a spectator of markets and somebody that's dedicated their life to doing this, it is insane, but it's also remarkable the things that we're seeing. I think we're seeing valuations in companies that I didn't think were possible. And that's probably foolish on my part, because if you're in markets long enough, you should know not count anything off, or not count anything out. Anything can happen. But just give us an idea, Toby, of how crazy this really is and where we're at in terms of valuations.
Well, you're right that what we're in is an extremely unusual period in the markets. We've got data that goes back to about 1850, when it was the Standard and Poor's, I'm going to slightly blank on this, before it was even the S&P 500, and then it converts into the S&P 500 in about 1875 or something like that.
It was just the S. It was just standards.
Was it the standards? I can't remember. It's before they merged.
Poor's hadn't joined the firm yet. It was the S. Yeah, the S20.
So there are various different ways that you can look at the market level valuation, and you might look at, so one of the ways that I like to look at it is the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, the CAPE or the Shiller PE. And so what the reason that you cyclically adjust is there's a business cycle, and sometimes in the cycle you over earn or you earn a lot, and sometimes in the cycle, in a recession, you don't earn very much, and you want to get an average of those figures and sort of work out where you are from there. Because if you use the single year PE, for example, you can go back and look at what happened in 2008.
Right.
Because the bank earnings were so bad, the index earned nothing. And so, that was a very good time to be buying, even though it looked like the PE was, because the price divided by zero is infinite, it refs out on your spreadsheet, but that was a good time to be buying it. And the only way you would have known that is if you were using a cyclically adjusted measure like the Shiller CAPE. So that number is now pressing up against 39, and you can think about that as sort of like a 2.5% earnings yield, which is, out of that earnings yield you pay dividends and so on. So the measure of forward return, so you can turn that cyclically adjusted PE, you can invert it, and then you can look at what that has typically happened over the next decade. And so what that implies at that level, because the average is around 16, which is about a 6% earnings yield, that what that implies is forward returns on the index that are negative about 0.5% a year to about 0.8% a year. But then there is a dividend paid out of that as well. So the dividend will be it's historically around 1.3%. That's about the dividend yield. So my expectation is that the total return on the index will be slightly positive, only because you get to include the dividends. If you don't include the dividends, then it will be negative to the tune of about 0.5% to 0.8% over the next decade. The only other times when we've been more expensive than this is in like the last few months of 2000, at the very peak when we ran up to 44. There's nothing magic about any of those numbers. There's no reason why we stop at 44. That the Japanese stock market in the 1990s got to 100 times on the CAPE. The Chinese market recently got to 100 times. But it just makes it very difficult to continue to outperform. Now, the reasons why we're so elevated are easy to understand. It's because the alternatives are also very expensive. So the 10-year treasury is currently about 1.3% a year. It's just very, very difficult to find any place to earn unless you're prepared to do something a little bit to look in an alternative, like a value fund or something like that, where the things that are very hot at the moment, so these NFTs and CryptoKitties, the apes and the, what other silliness have I seen, penguins that people are spending lots of money on, those things are going to be probably zeros once this is all over. The SPACs are sort of more popular, where you pay more than a dollar for a dollar of cash that does nothing other than buy something and dilute you when it's bought and give the founders a big rip, 20% of the business when they get bought. You know, to me, none of those things are particularly appetizing, certainly not the 10-year at 1.3%, which is probably, you know, inflation, the last print on inflation, and you don't necessarily have to believe these figures, but if anything, they're sandbagging to the downside. The last print was 5.4%, so 1.3% is a negative, is a real yield of about negative 4.1%. I can think of better things to do with my money than lose 4.1% a year for the next decade. So that's why we get these valuations. All of the alternatives are exceptionally expensive, and that's because the Fed has pinned them where they are, and they're flooding the market with a lot of cash in an effort to prop up asset prices. Because for some reason they've got this idea that lower asset prices is a bad thing. As a value investor, I think it's a good thing. But for some reason, people like to look at where their assets are trading in the market, and so they don't want to see them go down. Even though what that implies is lower forward returns. Typically, what's happened in the past is that this market, that this has led to a clearing of the market, which is quite a big, you know, bear market, like a 2000-2002 bear market or 2007-2009 style bear market. That doesn't have to happen. It could just be that we get very anemic returns for the next decade. And I think you need to look at alternatives if you want to earn more than, if you want to earn a positive real return. That's going to be tough to do in this market.
You know, we've said this before, but especially when I start having these conversations with you, my mind just goes back to 1968. The analog just lines up so well. And then we all know, you know, I can't remember exactly what the returns were, but if I'm not mistaken, from 1968 to 1983, I believe the S&P was negative for that 15-year period of time. Does that sound right? Maybe it was to 1981.
Yeah, so the big periods are, so Vitaly Katsenilson, who's a friend of mine, has done this great work. He's written a book called The Little Book of Sideways Markets, and his idea is that basically there are two, you don't really ever see bear markets over extended periods of time, although he says that the Great Depression, stock, the Great Crash was a bear market. Typically, what you see is a sideways market, other than these periods where you have a bull market. So, from 66 to 81, that was a very nasty sideways market that included the 73-74 crash, which, on a real basis, was worse than 1929 because there was stagflation going on at the same time. There's an enormous amount of money printing in an effort to prop up prices, and the consumer price index ran away. So I think that's a very good analogy for this current period, because I think we've got a similar market. It's that bifurcated market where you have the Nifty 50, which, you know, that was the 50 best stocks, which in the 60s you could, and in the early 70s you could buy at any price. This is what they said: you could buy them at any price because they're such good businesses. You'll be bailed out eventually by the growth in the underlying business.
One decision stocks, right?
One decision stocks, exactly right. And so you'd have this, and that worked fine until it didn't. In 73 and 74, these two back-to-back brutal bear markets, they're not as well known in the popular imagination as 29, even though on a real basis, which is like the figure that you really care about because it's what you can actually consume, rather than what just is written down on the index, it was much worse than 1929. And so I think that we're in a similar scenario now where there's many, many companies that are regarded as one-decision stocks. That they're so expensive, I think it's going to be hard for them to do much more than tread water for a decade. But in the interim, you can have quite a lot of volatility. And it is very similar to that period. I'm always a little bit nervous about saying it is going to be exactly like this period, because it's, you know, there's so many different elements. And 2000 is a pretty good analogy too, where the market was just split in two. There were parts that were very, very expensive. And, well, that's what we're seeing now. And then on the other hand, there are parts that are just, they're reasonably cheap. They're reasonably good value, but they just don't have the narrative. The story around them is not as exciting as the story around the really expensive stuff. But, you know, you just got to look past the narrative, and you got to look at the financial statements to see what they're actually delivering, I think, in order to make your decisions. Many times when you hear these guys talk, they tell great stories. But when you think about what that implies for what the stock has to do over the next decade for you to even earn a market return, and this is in a market that's expensive, they really have to do some things that stocks have never done before. And it's possible, anything's possible, but, you know, for them all to do it, I think it's very unlikely.
At some point, the party's got to come to an end. And the thing that I try to wrap my head around is we talk about a big nasty bear. Again, you don't want to make these extrapolations, because you do and you'll get humbled pretty quick. But I can't see the Fed allowing it, man. I think that what they did, and again, we've talked about this at great length, but, you know, what they did back in March, you know, taking what they buy up. I mean, they put $2.5 trillion in that SPAC, or that special purpose vehicle SPAC. Might as well call it a SPAC, right? And they only ended up buying about, what, $680 or $700 billion of corporates. But if they're willing to buy $700 billion worth of corporates, I that's the thing to me that is just, you know, just bends the mind and cramps my brain, because it's like they got a tiger by the tail and they're just never going to let up.
That's fair. But I think that the two things that I would say to that is, you can look at what they did in 2000 on the way down. They were firing that cannon all the way down. And they did it in 2007 and 8 as well, firing that big cannon all the way down. In March 30, they fired the biggest cannon that anybody's ever seen before. And that did sort of have this, it seems to have had this psychological impact on the participants in the market that made them go back in and participate. I think that in retrospect now, what March 2020 looks more like is a sort of flash crash, that even though on the way down it was more precipitous than 1929, 1987, which is kind of extraordinary, it did bounce equally and then ran much, much higher than either of those two preceding instances. So I wouldn't regard that as a bear market, which a bear market looks more like you spend a year drifting sideways and then you have sort of 6 months to 12 months of terror, and it feels like you're never ever going to get out of it, because every rally gets sold and you're 15 or 16 rallies into it, and just when the last person no longer believes that the market can rally again, that's when it seems to rally. So I think that what that March 2020 showed was that if the Fed can capture the public imagination and get that psychology right, then it will work. If they can't, then you could have a 2000 or 2007 scenario where they just keep on firing the cannon and nothing happens. And you can look for an external example of that to Japan, which invented the term quantitative easing, has done every single thing that the Fed is doing now. They invented all of this stuff. They created ETFs that own an enormous portion of the market. They own all of the JGBs, that's the government bonds. They've been trying this, and it hasn't worked since 1990. They're now sort of 30-something years below their peak, despite the fact that they've been doing all this printing. It's entirely possible that happens. Again, the same caution applies. The analogy is not perfect. The US has got a younger workforce. It's a little bit of a more dynamic economy. It's a much bigger economy. So it may not be a direct analogy. But I just think it's a reasonable... I don't think you can rely on the fact that the Fed we'll bail you out. I don't think that that Fed put really exists other than sort of as a psychological thing that sometimes it seems to work, but it doesn't work every time. It's not reliable.
Yeah, no, and when the psychology turns, it turns. It really is remarkable to see what the marketplace is still buying and what they're passing up on. I continue to sit there and look. It feels like this to me, Toby, where, again, I know full well that there's no limit on this kind of stuff. There's no limit to how insane it can get. But holy smokes, the spreads in terms of valuations between the parts of the market that have not been hot and the parts that are, it is just... it's mind-numbing to the point where, you know, it's not me telling the market it's wrong. And we've had a pretty dang good year. But it's not me telling the market it's wrong. Just looking at it and going through the numbers and sitting there looking at these two companies going, if we're looking at this through rational eyes or with any type of fundamental bent at all, it is just really hard to wrap your head around why you'd buy that and not buy this. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of
Absolutely.
A sloppy, it's mind-numbing.
I think I've had, you know, I've been humbled so many times over the last decade that I've sort of got to the point where I recognize that people are going to do silly things with their money, and I'm happy for them to go and do that, and it's sort of none of my business that they do that. I just think about my approach to the market is all I'm looking for is a very specific kind of thing. I want something that has a pretty predictable stream of cash flows going out over, say, the next 10 or 20 years. And then I'm just trying to buy that at a reasonable price that gives me enough sort of margin for safety for those returns to sort of earn their way in. And I think that, funnily enough, when the market gets split like this, where there are parts of the market that are very hot and there's a lot of money chasing it, it's almost like these other ones get forgotten a little bit. And so it does create good opportunities for guys like us who are prepared to dig into the financial statements and the fundamentals and make sure that we're actually getting some earnings. So I feel quite positive about the prospects for value and the prospects for my own portfolio in this market, regardless of what happens to the index. And you can certainly have that experience. You can certainly have that, as we saw with the 2000 experience, where the market collapses. And it did initially take down some of the value stocks, because there's just that, you know, when everybody starts selling, you're sort of subject to you're in the washing machine with everybody else. But you get this period pretty quickly after that where stuff is so cheap that a financial guy who doesn't really need to know much about the strategy of the business can just see that they're too cheap, and they can go in and they can do things to these businesses. They can take them over for the cash on the balance sheet or take them over with a little bit of debt. So I think that the stuff that we're in, if the market goes down, management will buy back stock, or the private equity guys will come in and do something. And so I think that it's a little bit of a better part of the market to be in, even though the index could get rinsed pretty heavily. And you know, as we've seen a number of times, that the start of this year, the techie stocks really sold off hard, and then they had this little rally in the second quarter, and they seem to have sort of gone back now into, they've been selling off pretty hard through Q3 as well. And that behavior is not unusual. A similar thing happened in 2000, where there was the initial crack and the index was down sort of, this is the index of the techie stocks. They were down 35 to 50%. Then they almost rallied all the way back to their all-time high, which was a little bit of a heartbreaker for the value guys who were around at that time. And they didn't quite get there, didn't quite kiss it, but came very close. And that was when the real heartbreaker crash occurred in the second half of that crash, which then took down the index. I think that we're midway through this process. I think it's sort of already occurring under the covers, and it's the index, you know, the index has got some reasonably priced big good companies in it. I think a lot of the, you know, so funnily enough, I think Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google, they're expensive, but, you know, given where the 10-year is, they're not totally unreasonable. Microsoft, I'd throw that in there too. That's sort of what's propping up the index, and their earnings are strong and going up.
And Facebook, like you threw in Facebook and Google, you back cash off the balance sheet into that valuation metric, they're not expensive.
Right. That's
not, Not when you look at their revenue growth and earnings growth. I mean,
that's right.
They're still relatively cheap.
And that's a big part of the index.
Yeah. Right. Now, the interesting one to me, though, is that it really doesn't even make sense on a valuation basis. When you look at the growth rates, look at the profitability, do all that, it's a bit odd to me that Amazon and Apple are valued so highly above those other the Google and Facebook, too. That doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm with you. They're not, you know, the best business in the market, I think, it's either Microsoft or Google, one of those two, because you have a look at those businesses. There's no capital in them at all. They earn massive amounts of money. Everybody touches them. You know, everybody's got Word or Excel, or everybody's got a Gmail account or uses YouTube or something like that. Everybody touches those companies, basically, and they earn a little bit of money from everybody. That's a different business to making hardware or even for consumer sort of gadgets, which is what Apple does. And very, very dominant consumer companies have fallen in the past. I'm not saying it's going to happen to Apple. I still think it's a very good business. It's just, it's not as good as the other two. Amazon, too, I think, you know, it's a retailer. Retail's a tough business. There's a lot of competition in that business. Amazon's probably dominant enough that nothing happens, but they shouldn't be at a premium, I don't think, to Google and Microsoft, which is where they are at the moment. Google and Microsoft are, you know, reasonable values, I think.
You know, the Google one has surprised. I've been baffled by that one. And we've made really good money on it. And as a long-term shareholder, which people are always surprised to hear that we own Google in a value portfolio.
It's a value stock.
I mean, from my eye, it is certainly in this market. Certainly. It is really odd to me that one hasn't attracted more capital. I look at the numbers they're throwing up. I look at everything and I go, I do not understand why you would pay the multiple you would for Apple and pass on Google. It just makes zero sense to me.
You know, I think it's because Google spends a lot of money on these moonshot bets. Like, they kind of hide how profitable they are, which is interesting, because there aren't very many companies that do that. Google sandbags a little bit because I think if people realized how much money they were making, somebody might show up to the front door with pitchforks. It's a great business.
I know, but then everybody applauds Amazon. It's by a different mechanism, but Amazon's essentially doing the same thing, right? I mean, and they applaud Amazon for that same deal. And again, Amazon's a little bit different because they're both investing earnings, right? Which is, you know, bringing down their tax liability and making their earnings look artificially small. But at the same time, we all applaud Amazon for it, and then Google gets hammered. It's another one of these discrepancies in the market that I just haven't been able to. I don't know.
Google's just a tougher business to understand. There's just more businesses in it, more moving parts, I think, and it's actively disguising how much money it actually makes. So I think that Google really does hide in plain sight. Amazon, too, to some extent. That was sort of Amazon's great trick. If you looked at it on a gross profits to total assets basis, which is a measure of sort of how much money it makes for how much money is invested in that business, Amazon has always been this spectacular business, but very little of it fell to the bottom line because Jeff Bezos is smart. He knows that if you pay tax, you can't reinvest that in your business. So he's minimized his tax the whole way through. He's not run it the way that a public company has typically been run, where you sort of you say that you're making more money than you actually are. He's gone the other way and sort of disguised how profitable it is. Google's just the same thing. You know, it's really controlled by Page, Brin, and Schmidt, because they're the only three shareholders who count. They're the only ones with voting stock. Everybody else has got non-voting shares. So they don't trade their shares, I don't think. That Goog and Google, G-O-O-G-L, are the only ones that the public can invest in, and neither of them vote. So I think that there's probably some, you know, maybe that's a little bit concerning, maybe. But, you know, then again, they've run it so well for so long that, Google's a puzzler, but it's difficult to believe that it is as good as it is when, you know, everybody's been disappointed many, many times in these higher growth businesses where you have to pay an optically high multiple for them. But Google, you know, absolute cash machine that hides how much it's making and has all of these incredible bets in it. You know, that like the self-driving cars, they're probably leading in self-driving cars, and not many folks would know that. You know, YouTube's probably the biggest streamer on the internet. everybody's got a Gmail account, and on and on and on with all of these moonshot bets. It's a really spectacular company, and you're not even paying for those things that if they come off, you're sort of paying on current earnings. It's still a pretty impressive business.
Yeah, that's why I can't seem to let it go. It's just a tough one to cut loose, man, you know, for all the reasons you just mentioned.
I think it's one of those things you just hold for 10 or 20 or 30 years, and it'll just be much, much bigger and of that for years. And it's kind of extraordinary to say that, because in many ways, these companies defy what other businesses have been able to achieve in the past. They're doing something completely unusual. Amazon, too. Amazon, on $100 billion of revenue, printed a 45% increase year over year through 2020 last year. Like, that's just extraordinary. There's nothing in the market like that. We've never seen these growth rates for companies this big, which is some of the reason why these other internet companies trade so expensively. Because, and this is what I was alluding to earlier when I said, you know, if you project forward what the expectations are for these businesses, they're sort of assuming that all of them become Amazons and Googles.
100%, yes.
You know, those things are remarkable because they are so rare. It's very, very difficult to achieve that. And so I think that there should be more skepticism for some of these things that are earlier in their journey and unproven. They shouldn't trade as if they've already achieved many of the more difficult things that Microsoft and Amazon and Google have. You know, it takes a little while for it to sort of, for them to disappoint, for that to work its way through the market. But I think it's unlikely, you know, just as a matter of physics or logic or math, that these things get to the same point. And they're sort of projecting that there'll be very significant parts of GDP, you know, for them to,
right,
to earn sufficient. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, no, I know. And you know, even to the top of those companies, you know, one of the things, I was having a conversation with a client of mine yesterday, and we were having we were discussing the same topic. And I just said, you know, if for no other reason, you know, even you take those outstanding companies at the top of the index, you know, and if you're advocating to buy those and you think that maybe they have, you know, because if you're buying an individual stock, you're essentially making the declaration that you believe that that individual company will outperform the index, right?
Right.
So that means that if you hold the averages out, that really what you're expecting those businesses to keep growing, at least the share appreciation, right, that they keep appreciating in value somewhere north of 11% a year, right? Well, run that out for 5 years and then show me what the market cap looks like. You'd have, yeah, you know, Apple and Amazon alone would make up 40% of U.S. GDP. Right? I mean, that's just the math.
Maybe. I don't think the politicians will let it get there, but it's...
Right. Right. And that's my point, because can you in the biggest economy in the world, could you have two companies valued at 40% of GDP and not be monopolies that have to get busted up? I mean, right. If that's not the definition of a monopoly, what would be? You there?
Hello, mate. You still there?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. So, hold on. Let me make a note. Yeah. Every once in a while, you've been cutting out. Let me write this time down. So anyway, I'll just say it. You know, again, so if you're buying an individual stock, you're expecting it to outpace the performance of the index. If the index holds steady, you know, assuming an 11% historical return, you know, these things got to be appreciating somewhere between 12-15%. You run that out for 5 years. I mean, you'd be looking at the definition of monopoly. You'd look at two companies that have that are worth 40% U.S. GDP. My feeling is that if you get there, which I'm not going to say is impossible, for God's sakes, Tesla's redefined what I believe is possible in the investment world. And congratulations to the people that have been long. Not dogging you at all. It's a performance game, and congratulations. But you know, you get to two, you know, you get up to 40% of GDP on two companies, the pitchforks are going to come out. I mean, there's just no way.
That's right, which is why I think Google sandbags a little bit, because they don't want everybody to know. And I think that, you know, Google probably collects as much information on you as Facebook does. It's just, yeah, that everybody gets a little bit of that ick feeling when they open up Facebook. And I don't know how many people actually go onto Facebook.com anymore. But, you know, Google's got just as much information on you through all of these other, you know, your search history and so on. And you just don't really notice it. They hide themselves much better. But, you know, that's not going to protect them if, you know, there are various ways that they've sort of tweaked politicians that could result in, you know, antitrust or some sort of free speech type amendment that that pushes those things through. So there's some risk in there, but I still think that they're very good businesses. And the US has a track record for knocking some of the bigger companies on the head. They did that with AT&T. They did that with Microsoft. And so it's entirely possible that does happen, that Microsoft... I think that Microsoft perhaps is safer because they don't really have other than... they don't really have that as much lock-in other than in sort of the Word and Excel and so on. Having said that, the point that you make that, you know, for them to outperform the index, they're a big part of the index, so that's going to be difficult for them to do. And you have to remember that they have lots of levers too. They have, you know, they've got the revenue growth, they've got the bottom line, and that they spend enormous amounts of money that they could just titrate more of that, let it fall through to the bottom line. They can also buy back stock if they get cheaply. All of that sort of concentrates in. And that's what I look at that in the companies that I buy, that optically they might not be as attractive, or superficially they're not as attractive, but if you dig in and you see what management's doing, it's entirely possible that the stock outperforms the business. And I still think the business is also going to do well. And that's sort of the ideal scenario, where you've got a very good, growing, predictable, safe business with a management team that knows what it's doing. Where they get too cheap, they buy it up. Put all of that together, and I think it is reasonable to expect that they will outperform the index. Going to be lots of mistakes in those portfolios. I'm not predicting that's what's going to happen for each and every one of them, but for the ones that it does happen for, the market will eventually figure it out, and it will react to that, and it should trade at a reasonable multiple to reflect that. But the point that you make is exactly right. It's extremely difficult for these bigger companies to grow materially in the existing economy without sort of attracting some sort of attention from politicians, either at a state level or a federal level.
Yeah, it is really mind-numbing. Well, hey, pal, we gotta wrap it up here on time constraints. Any before we do it, because we do have a little bit left. Anything of particular interest that you've noticed, any particular sector, anything that's popped up on your radar? Maybe it was something that popped into your head while you were floating around Bass Lake with the family. Anything that has popped up on your radar that we should keep an eye out on?
Well, the thing that I've been thinking about the last decade was really this: tech got too cheap. You know, so there was that 2000 crash, and then there was a decade of pain in tech. And nobody went near tech until sort of 2010 to 2015. People started reinvesting, and it was all too cheap. And that's why it had the spectacular run through the back half of 2015 to date. If you go back and look at other instances, and you think about other parts of the market where that could happen. You know, we had this commodity super cycle. Remember that when China, we were all selling into China, and that was the growth of that was the thing that was going to drive investment returns forever.
Absolutely.
And that was sort of 2000 to 2010. And if you look at that same scenario now, I think that is similarly priced into or not priced into the market, where there's a lot of money printing going on. Typically when that happens, commodities do really well. Gold probably is reasonably primed, reasonably valued in this kind of market. And there's a lot of gold miners out there that they got religion over the last decade. You know, but previously when everything goes really well for them, they spend too much on gold mines, they spend too much on talent, mm-hmm. they issue a whole lot of stock. Like, they do all the things that the tech companies are doing right now. You know, they just spend too much on acquisitions and paying themselves. And so they're not great investments right at the time when they look best. And the reverse is true now. They've tidied up their balance sheets. They've tidied up their shareholder registers. They're being paid appropriately. The ones that are, and they've bought back a whole lot of stock, and the ones that have the clean balance sheets are now making money in a market where gold is, where's gold? 1700, something like that?
1750, 1780, somewhere there.
So they're making money here, and you've got to think that you've got this reasonable asymmetric bet where for the next decade, gold probably, if it delivers its historical returns, these things are levered to that gold price. They've got an enormous amount of operational leverage against that gold price by virtue of the fact they are tidy. So I think that it's going to be a surprising decade for folks who've only seen tech, because I think it could be a reversal to these things like the commodity miners, energy. you know, all of that stuff that's very uncool at the moment. This is just what happens in markets. They cycle like this. And I think that we could, in a decade, we could be talking about what a spectacular decade it was for commodities and what a bad decade it was for tech. And then you and I would be buying tech.
Yeah, right. That's from your lips to God's ears, pal. Well, hey, anyway, Toby, as always, man, always great to catch up with you. Really appreciate the time. And for those of you interested in Toby's value approach, we certainly are. He is the only outside manager whose work and fund that we own in our value portfolio. So I think that, you know, that says a lot. I'm putting my livelihood on his shoulder. No pressure, pal. No pressure. But for those of you interested in his funds, you can get them ZIG, Z-I-G, and DEEP, D-E-E-P. And, you know, I think if you're looking for that value exposure, if you realize this market needs to rotate at some point, those will get you done. And you can't have anybody that's better and more studied in the space of value and is also just a genuinely good guy. So, Toby, thanks so much for being with us today. And, you know, if you see anything of note, man, don't hesitate to tap me on the shoulder. We'll get you back on for another value update and a saunter through the world of value as you see it.
I love it. Thanks so much for having me on, Zach. It's always my great pleasure.
Oh, you bet. All right, you guys. Well, we got to cut it off there due to time constraints. Thank you so much for listening today. Have a wonderful week. We will be back next week, as always, with some more interviews dialed up. We're getting back into interview season, so you don't want to miss it. As always, you can download the podcast at knowyourriskradio.com. Well, Stitcher.com. Just Google Know Your Risk Radio podcast. You can find it anywhere. You'll get automatically updated with all of our episodes, and hopefully you get something out of them. But have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.